holy shrine of an infallible. The late Sheikh Murtaza Ha'eri, one of the close friends of the late Imam Khomeini, loved Imam Reza's holy shrine very much. Whenever he found a chance, he went to pay a visit to the holy shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad. He was dedicated to Imam Reza to the extent that even he swept and cleaned the courtyard of the holy shrine.
ایشون یه مرتبه داشت میرفت زیارت امام رضا، بیرون حرم بود. میگه من خیلی مراقب خودم بودم، حواسم جمع باشه، مثل یه موقعی آدم میخواد بره.
Once when he was entering the holy shrine of Imam Reza, one of his relatives recognized him and went to him to greet. When he reached the Shaykh was so much busy with supplication and attention to the holy shrine that he couldn't greet him back warmly and gave the man a cold welcome. The man left and the Shaykh wanted to enter the holy shrine when a great scholar saw him and said, "You may not be welcome today to the holy shrine because of your behavior with the man." Upon hearing this, the Shaykh got sad and left the holy shrine and asked for the man from his relatives. He went to him and asked for his forgiveness. The next morning, when he went to the holy shrine, he saw the great scholar at the entrance again, who told him, "This time, Imam Reza alayhi salam is happier with your entrance to his holy shrine." This incident shows that entering the holy shrine of an infallible has its own formal and divine etiquettes. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014. And since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school. Two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbass separatists.
The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done.
A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that will kill or injure
anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them. Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling, and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many like Yulia prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery. While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. Indeed, as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Ukraine for weapons to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these 2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The first commercial flight has landed at Sana'a International Airport almost 7 years after the Saudi-led coalition forced the facility to shut down its ordinary air travel. The opening takes place 6 weeks behind the schedule after a UN brokered ceasefire was enforced in early April. This is due to repeated delays by the Saudi-led coalition under different pretexts.
نستقبل اليوم الطائرة الخطوط الجوية اليمنية وهي الرحلة الأولى بعد إغلاق الدائرة.
Today the first civilian plane has arrived at Sana'a Airport after a closure that lasted for more than 6 years, and there is a flight that will go to Amman Airport in Jordan carrying 130 passengers. The turnout is large, and people are eager to travel through Sana'a Airport amid the exceptional circumstances and the large number of patients. We call on the United Nations and all international organizations to demand that the Saudi-led coalition stop its siege and open the airport without any restrictions.
Officials say thousands of patients are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Keeping the airport closed has pushed many Yemeni patients desperate to seek medical treatment abroad to the brink amid their critical health conditions.
We were not able to travel through another airport because of the difficulty of traveling by road and the rugged roads. As my health situation was critical and I couldn't take the long way to another city.
There was a deliberate delay by the Saudi-led coalition to operate flights through Sana'a's airport, especially since 41 days have passed since the implementation of the UN-brokered truce. We hope that Yemeni civilians will profit from the opening of the airport, that the truce will be extended, and that the airport will continue to be operational, as it's a civilian airport that does not serve any military authority.
Under the two-month truce that was brokered by the United Nations at the beginning of April, there should be two flights from Egypt and Jordan and back there every week. However, the truce will end in 2 weeks and the terms of the armistice have not yet been implemented.
People here hope that the UN-brokered truce will be extended and that Sana'a International Airport will always be open to humanitarian flights, as it is a humanitarian necessity to save the lives of thousands of patients, including children, who are waiting for the chance to travel abroad for treatment. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was supposed to ensure seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island. The most recent reason, the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party, Sinn Féin, came top for the first time ever. The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who wanted to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy and the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
The Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the post-Brexit withdrawal agreement, aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it. But to the EU, that is anathema.
The unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place.
Boris Johnson clearly wanted to get Brexit done. And so he promised just about anything to the unionists to get them to agree. At the same time, the unionists had a vested interest in staying good friends with the British, the Westminster government, because a rift with them would be very damaging for the unionist cause. Now they've got to live with those consequences.
It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government, led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and unionists in Northern Ireland.
and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
Sharing the same mindset toward the U.S., Iran and Cuba are set to expand their partnership. Cuba's Deputy Prime Minister Ricardo Cabrizas made this comment in Tehran at the 18th meeting of the Iran-Cuba Joint Economic Commission.
I would like to reiterate Cuba's resolute will to expand its ties with the Islamic Republic of Iran in all areas. We are here to find solutions to illegal measures taken against us by our common enemy.
Iran and Cuba have already had close ties in the health sector. Pastokovac is a COVID vaccine produced jointly by Iranian and Cuban biotech firms. The two sides now hope to build on this successful cooperation and extend it to other fields.
Pastokovac has been one of the major vaccines that are injected to our people today. It's a result of successful joint efforts made by Iranian and Cuban scientists. We're determined to adopt the same synergy in other fields as well.
The 17th meeting of the Joint Economic Commission of the two countries was held in Havana in December 2016, shortly after the conclusion of the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus 1. Everything was going to change for better, but the reimposition of sanctions on Iran in 2018, following the U.S. pullout from the deal, killed all chances for Iran and Cuba to do business smoothly.
Despite their long-standing ties in scientific and political areas, Tehran and Havana have not done well when it comes to bilateral trade. Last year, Iran's exports to Cuba were almost zero, with its imports standing at a trivial $2,500. Both sides are now poised to give it a jump start, but they need to overcome stringent U.S. sanctions targeting both countries.
Cruel and inhumane was how the two officials described U.S. sanctions. However, both are determined to, quote, neutralize the embargoes using non-dollar channels such as bartering.
Iran and Cuba's common enemies will never succeed in trying to stop our revolutionary development. We will work together with Iran to adopt bartering and other banking mechanisms that will render ineffective and United States illegal and unilateral economic measures against our nations.
Based on Cabrisa's three-day itinerary, the two sides will sign agreements in the fields of oil and petrochemical industry, mining and nanotechnology, among others. Closer ties with Cuba, among other Latin American countries, come as part of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi's new approach toward foreign policy and his attempt to avoid tying the economy to the 2015 deal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A 74-second siren was sounded across the West Bank at 12 noon local time, marking the 74 years that have passed since their Nakba, the catastrophe. Demonstrators from all walks of life and of all ages held maps of historical Palestine and large metal keys to symbolize their homes from which were forced to leave decades ago. The anniversary also comes as anger is boiling over the Israeli killing of prominent Al Jazeera veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akleh.
Nakba anniversary has always been painful to all the Palestinians, and this year is more painful. Like every year, we commemorate our Nakba to tell the world that our homeland is unforgettable. That's why you can see people are still holding the keys to their ancestors' homes, as they still believe that they will return to their homes one day, and hopefully it'll be very soon.
Nearly 5 million Palestinian refugees remain scattered in different camps in the besieged Gaza Strip, the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, Lebanon, Jordan and Syria, including others dispersed around the world. All of them have a mutual dream, which is returning to historical Palestine.
Since 1948, Palestinians have remained steadfast in defending their right to return to their homeland despite Israel's continued ethnic cleansing policies. For Palestinians, Nakba remains a painful episode in history, and the agony continues to be felt amid Israel's escalated violence and crimes. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Yet again, London streets have been brought to a standstill by pro-Palestinian activists calling for an end to Israeli crimes against humanity in the occupied territories. Such events are building momentum, and the calls for the last apartheid on earth to be dismantled are growing louder.
Atrocities are committed in the occupied Palestinian territories on a daily basis, from ethnic cleansing to murder. And for decades, Western media has managed to downplay the severity of the situation. But now, with social media and so many cameras recording the madness, it's almost impossible to bury the truth.
Only days earlier, a prominent Palestinian journalist died when she was shot in the face by Israeli forces. She was reporting on an army raid in the West Bank. Her death caused outrage, and scenes of her coffin bearers being beaten by Israelis made headlines. 229 rights groups have called for Israel to be held accountable for what they call a premeditated assassination. At Saturday's protest, Shirin Abu Akleh's life and work was honoured.
I feel that we have the duty to come here and to do that and to speak out. For example, just Shirin the other day was murdered, and all the reports, the news channels, they're reporting it as clashes. Even in her funeral, the clips that I saw were disgusting. And still, again, the way that they are being reported is as clashes. Now, Germany, they wanted to hold a protest for the murdered journalist, but Germany was not allowing them to do so.
There is a trade relation between Britain and Israel, which includes arms sales. So this country, Britain, buys armaments from Israel, which are being announced as tested on Palestinian people. So people always think that Britain is arming Israel, but it is not a one-way street. Britain is also buying arms from Israeli arms companies. And there are Israeli arms companies who are operating in Britain as well. They're producing in Britain.
A raft of new measures limiting public protest were recently added to the already controversial policing bill, and it might also become illegal to boycott, divest and sanction entities like Israel, robbing public bodies of their right to make ethical decisions. It's the information age, and it remains to be seen how the UK hopes to maintain its democratic persona now that its grip on the media has loosened. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As higher oil prices mean more oil pumping, all of the big names of Iran's oil industry have assembled here to multiply the country's oil output amid rising crude prices. The 26th edition of the International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition brought together 1,200 Iranian and 44 international firms active in upstream, midstream and downstream oil sectors.
We produce a range of medium pressure and high pressure cables, lead sheet head cables for use in petrochemical industries and oil and gas. We have been operating since 1992 and have been supplying our domestic oil firms with our cables, which otherwise would have to go through the process of importing from other countries amid the complications caused by the sanctions.
Our company has been running for 39 years in the production of more than 400 types of metal fasteners and holders from various materials such as iron, copper, aluminium, stainless steel and alloy, among others. We have worked with major foreign companies supplying them with insulation, pipe clamps, cold line shoes, and so on.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by the U.S. and China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran have made it almost impossible to import quality bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This has forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery, including drilling bits.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
NATO critics say the alliance's expansion is what led to the war in Ukraine, and now moves are afoot to provoke Moscow even further. It looks almost certain that Finland, and most probably Sweden, are to join NATO. Via video link, senior Helsinki officials set out their case to the European Parliament on Thursday as to why Finland would fit right in.
Finland has many high-end capabilities, including a fighter jet fleet of F-80s, gradually to be replaced by recently ordered 64 F-80s. F-35 jet fighters.
Sweden's Malin Björk asked, what's the rush given that her country and Finland have said they don't feel under immediate threat? However, it seems most EU lawmakers are supportive.
We think that it is not only defining for Finnish security, but it's only an important step in European history.
Finland's border with Russia stretches for 1,300 kilometres. Membership would mean NATO's land border with the Federation would more than double. The Kremlin has warned there will be military retaliation if the plan goes ahead. Experts aren't ruling out the possibility of World War III.
This creates a major problem, because when you change the architecture of security, of course, you create waves of reaction and perceived threats, which is the case for Russia now.
The US and its European allies are spending enormous amounts of money on arming Ukraine. One EU lawmaker criticized this during Thursday's proceedings.
We have a very powerful arms industry in the European Union, and many nations rely on arms exports. We should be doing all we can to prevent conflicts escalating instead.
Analysts say it could take up to a year for Finland to fully join NATO, but in the meantime, it will become a de facto member. The question is, in the event of escalation, will it be viewed as protected or as a target? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the US, Republican politicians, including some of the party's top leaders, openly espouse versions of a white supremacist conspiracy theory, holding that an orchestrated effort is underway to displace white Americans. A recently published opinion poll found that almost half of Republicans believe that immigrants are being brought to the United States as part of such an effort. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times and has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper. The piece is titled, "The Buffalo Shooting Was Not a Random Act of Violence." US Republican politicians, including some of the party's top leaders, openly espouse versions of a white supremacist conspiracy theory, holding that an orchestrated effort is underway to displace white Americans. A recently published opinion poll found that almost half of Republicans believe that immigrants are being brought to the United States as part of such an effort. On Saturday, 14th of May, a gunman who said he was motivated by a version of this so-called replacement theory killed 10 people at a Buffalo, New York grocery store, according to officials. The suspect, identified as Peyton S. Gendron, wrote in an online diatribe that he sought to kill black people because he wanted to prevent white people from losing their rightful control of the country. Peyton Gendron described himself as part of a movement. He said that he was inspired by similar attacks on other minority communities and that he hoped others would follow his example. The suspects in several mass killings in recent years, including the 2015 murder of 9 black worshippers at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, the 2018 murder of 11 Jewish worshippers at a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the 2019 murder of 51 Muslim worshippers at a pair of mosques in New Zealand, and the 2019 murder of 23 people, many of them Latinos, in El Paso, Texas, also propounded versions of this racist worldview. American life is punctuated by mass shooting incidents that are routinely described as idiosyncratic. But these attacks are not random acts of violence. They are part of a long American history of political violence perpetrated by white supremacists against black people and other minority groups. Politicians who have employed some of the vocabulary of replacement theory generally do not make explicit calls for violence. The office of one of those politicians, Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, said in a statement that the Buffalo attack was an act of evil and that she has never advocated for any racist position. But the matter is not so simple. Replacement theory is an attack on democracy. It privileges the purported interests of some Americans over those of others, asserting, in effect, that the will of the people means the will of white people. It rekindles fears and resentments among white Americans that cynical practitioners of American politics have stoked throughout the nation's history. It also provides a disturbing rationalization for people inclined to resort to violence when the political process does not deliver what they want or protect what they see as their place in society. The Fox News Channel host, Tucker Carlson, a leading purveyor of replacement theory rhetoric, has promoted the idea that elites are seeking to replace white Americans on more than 400 episodes of his program on Fox News Channel, according to an analysis by the New York Times. Now, I know that the left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate. The voters now casting ballots with new people, more obedient voters from the third world, Tucker Carlson said on an episode in April of 2021. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Representative Matt Gaetz, a Florida Republican, later tweeted that Tucker Carlson is correct about replacement theory as he explains what is happening in America. In September, Elise Stefanik's re-election campaign paid for a Facebook advertisement that combined imagery of immigrants with the accusation that radical Democrats are planning their most aggressive move yet, a permanent election insurrection. Elise Stefanik's advertisement continued. Their plan to grant amnesty to 11 million illegal immigrants will overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority in Washington. Right-wing rhetoricians in the United States portray undocumented immigrants as the primary threat. This sanitizes replacement theory for mainstream consumption without diluting its logic. The same argument is easily applied to other minority groups in the United States. The French author Renaud Camus coined the term the Great Replacement in a 2011 book to describe what he saw as a conscious effort by French elite to open the country's doors for Muslim immigrants to replace the ethnically French population and French culture. The template has been adapted for use by extremists around the world. Mr. Gendron wrote that he blamed Jews for orchestrating the replacement of white Americans. He copied large portions of his manifesto from the document posted to justify the New Zealand killings, in some cases inserting the name of Jewish businessman George Soros in place of the former German Chancellor Angela Merkel's name. The manifesto posted by the El Paso shooting suspect, which Mr. Gendron also referenced, spoke of the Hispanic invasion of Texas. The common thread, the ineluctable core of replacement theory, is that some people are white and some people are not, and that the people who are white are threatened by those who are not. It must also be emphasized that the United States makes it easy for domestic terrorists to kill. The police said that the Buffalo assailant used a Bushmaster XM-15 rifle that he had purchased legally at a gun shop near his hometown. As a practical matter, almost anyone can buy guns that are designed to kill a lot of people quickly. The only real line of defense is the judgment of the people who sell guns. He didn't stand out, because if he did, I would have never sold him the gun, Robert Donald, the store's owner, told the New York Times. The focus on the gunman's motive should not obscure the fact that the most important step the government can take to impede similar attacks is to limit the availability of guns in the United States. The health of American democracy also requires the constructive use of free speech, especially by the nation's political leaders. There are always demagogues whose stock in trade is the demonization of immigrants and other minority groups. And American society has long allowed those on the fringes to air their views. The question in any era is whether such views are voiced or echoed by those in positions of responsibility. It is telling that House Republicans last year installed Elise Stefanik in leadership to replace Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, who remains among the most forthright critics of the Republican Party's illiberal turn. Liz Cheney tweeted on Monday, "The House GOP leadership has enabled white nationalism, white supremacy, and anti-Semitism. History has taught us that what begins with words ends in far worse. GOP leaders must renounce and reject these views and those who hold them." And Liz Cheney is certainly right.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahruddin was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarai that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars, jurists, and philosophers all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum to you both.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding scholars and ulama of the 13th century Hijra, originally from India. He is Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, but mainly known as Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi, the author of the magnum opus Abaghatul Anwar. We try to first take a look at his early life and then at his most outstanding book, that is Abaghat al-Anwar. Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you. Give us some information about the early life of Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Allama Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, or Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi, was born in 1246 according to lunar calendar in a village close to the Delhi, capital city of India. And as his name is showing, he was from Sadat. He was from the offspring of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And he is named as his grandfather Hamed Hussein. And when we want to trace back his lineage, he goes back to the children of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far alayhi salatu wasallam, mm-hmm. the seventh Imam of Shia, with 27 generations.
Generations, okay.
Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi started his Islamic teachings and Islamic studies when he was 6 years old. And he studied with different teachers, but mainly at the beginning of his studying, his father was the teacher that brought him up according to Islamic school of thought. And when he was 14, he came to study theology and some way finishing fiqh. He studied Islamic jurisprudence with the Sultan al-Ulama, Sayyid Muhammad bin Dildar Ali, mm-hmm. and also with the brother of his teacher, Sayyid al-Ulama, Sayyid Hussein bin Dildar Ali. Both of them were the scholars in India. Right. And you know, some of maybe these scholars are not well known to mm-hmm. the rest of Islamic world,
yes.
but they were well known at that time in India.
That's right.
And also he wrote a book, we should say a commentary, and the book of Manahij al-Tadqiq that was written by his teacher,
right.
Sayyid al-Ulama. Okay. And also he corrected and also tried to publish some of the works of his father,
right.
like Futuhat Haydariyya, Risale Taqiyya, Tashid al-Mata'in.
Mm-hmm.
And when he moved to Hajj, mm-hmm. he traveled to perform the pilgrimage of Hajj, and also went to Atawat Aliyat, to Karbala, Najaf, and Samarra, and Kadhimain.
Yes.
And then he came back to India, and from that moment on,
yes.
his life is, you know, more brilliant for
yes,
us, of
right.
course.
Okay.
And we have more information regarding this period of his life.
When we studied the life account of Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi and compare it with the other scholars of the Shia studies, we find him from India, something which is very much rare, because most of the scholars were either from Iran, Persia, or Iraq, Lebanon, you know. This man is from India. My point is this. He writes a book which becomes one of the most outstanding, you know, books in defense of the Shiism and the Shia beliefs, that is Abaghat al-Anwar. First of all, let's talk about the main intention of Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi to compile such a book. What was the main goal, Sheikh Mahtavi?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That is a good point. I may respond this way, that his main intention is loyalty to the
actually a school of thought of Ahlul Bayt, and to defend from the truth. Because in his area, I mean, since he's originally from India, we know that the actually population of Muslim there, I mean, Sunni brothers outnumbered Shia over there. So definitely they are going to have more scholars because of the facilities that they have there. But we see over there one book is being published entitled Tuhfatu Ithna Ashariyah. When we look at the title of this book, we see it has been actually written in a kind of downgrading Shia sect. That is not the approach of all Sunnis. They do not treat Shias like this. I mean, to entitle your book in a way that it is kind of mockery or making fun of the thing. So Tuhfat Ithna Ashariyah means the present or the gift of Ithna Ashariyah. So 12 words. So let's look at this gift. And then he, in his book, he's trying to reject
Abdul, a person by the name of Abdul Aziz al-Dihlawi.
Yes, this book
has authored this book in rejection of the Shia beliefs. So you want to say that Abaqat al-Anwar fi Imamat al-Aimmat al-Adhar was written as a rebuttal or an answer.
Yes, that was a rebuttal book. But before we get into this book, we have to know that at this, at its time, that book, I mean the book which had been produced by that Sunni author, was a good and strong book in a way that it was circulating among Shia scholars, but they wouldn't prepare a good response for that. By that moment, late Sayyid Mirhamed Hussein, he comes to this point that he has to benefit from all knowledge that he has gained through all those years.
That's right.
So he will produce a book which right now we can see that book in 10 volumes, although there are other records being 30 volumes or even 100 volumes.
Yes.
But what right now we have at hand is including 10 volumes. And the way he approached that Sunni book is regarded as a kind of very technical and respectful, because it is easy to refute something using words which are not appropriated for the field of actually scholarly field, or it is not appropriating the academic area. But when we look at his work, we see that the way he is approaching all things in his book is really, really professional.
That's right.
And this is because of the author, because he is regarded as one of the prolific authors.
That's right.
He knew many things about the Quran. He knew many things about the Riwayat. So he divides his book into two parts. First part, he actually approaches all verses that have been employed in the Sunni book in order to reject the idea of Shiism.
That's right.
So one by one, he will take all verses, that some of which are really familiar for our listeners, like Innama waliyakum Allah wa rasuluhu, or the other verse Al yawm akmaltu lakum dinakum, and the other verse that our listeners are familiar with. So he takes all these verses one after another, and he tries to actually refute the argument of the author in a way that, okay, Shiism had been and is being proven through these verses. And then he gets into the actually field of the Riwayat.
So more than Shiism, I think it is about the concept of imamat, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
That's
because,
which is the main pillar of the Shia
main
beliefs.
Pillar of Shia beliefs.
And so maybe so many people from our Muslim brethren believe that there is no direct reference to the concept of imamat in the Holy Quran. But Mir Hamad Hussein Hendi and so many other scholars have proven that there are direct incidents and events mentioned in the Holy Quran through the ayahs of the Holy Quran that show the authenticity of the concept of imamat and the leadership and the successorship. This is a specialized field of study. I mean, maybe by mere studying the text of the Holy Quran, some people might not understand it. But if we get to the shan and nuzul of the ayat and the different incidents, and you know, we have to know Arabic language, of course, and the exegesis of the Holy Quran, then we could understand that. That's right. Some references are made to the concept of imamat in the Holy Quran too. That's all right. So he wrote it in Farsi language, you know. And I think it is because the Farsi language was the mother tongue of that region, of the Indian subcontinent, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the Indian subcontinent.
Even we have Iqbal-e-Lahuri.
Iqbal-e-Lahuri writes in
composing
Farsi.
Composing poets in
Farsi. Farsi language, that's right. Yeah. Okay, that's all right. So, Sheikh Ziyaniel, let's get to you, brother. What information can you give us about Abaghat al-Anwar and the significance of this book? I mean, what is the high position of this book in the Shia library? Why is it so important?
As my brother, dear Sheikh Mahdavi, mentioned, this book is written according to the book of Tuhfa-i Ithna Ashariya. And because that book was Persian, this book is also Persian.
You mean as an answer to that book?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And Tuhfa-i Ithna Ashariya is consisted of 12 chapters. And each chapter is talking about proper aspect of Shia school of thought. For example, first chapter is talking about the history of Shia school of thought and gives accusations regarding Shia school of thought.
That's right.
And most important part of the book is chapter 7 that is regarding Imamat,
that's right.
And Abaghat al-Anwar and many other books, this is not the only Abaghat, some other books also are written in this regard. They are trying to defend the Shia school of thought regarding the subject of Imamat. And you know why? Because when the subject of Imamat is proved and is accepted, then all these discussions should be put on the shelves. Because the milestone and the root of every discussion in the theology of Islam between the denominations is the topic of Imamat. Because after the Holy Prophet's demise, we see that some of the Muslims, they try to say that, okay, the Holy Prophet did not appoint anyone. And some of Muslims, they would say that, no, Prophet appointed a person as his caliph and introduced Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. So if this discussion is solved, then the coming discussions that they are after this, they must be, all of them are put aside.
That's right.
And there's no negotiation anymore.
Okay.
Yes, I believe in this, you believe in that.
Yes.
No problem, but we should understand each other's, reasoning.
That's
why Abaghat is putting emphasis on this point.
That's right.
I mean, Imamat.
Yes.
Because this is the most basic difference between Shia school of thought and Sunni school
and
of
the beliefs,
thought.
That's right. How is his style of writing or compilation?
Yeah. Of course, because this book is trying to answer the problems that are raised by the book of Tuhfa-i Ithna Ashariya, so it's obvious that this book is going through the subject of that book, the first one, I mean, Tuhfa-i Ithna Ashariya. But Abaghat al-Anwar itself have this manner that at the beginning, when it's about riwayat, it's trying to give the sources of riwayat and then tries to give the chain of narrators and then try to convey a research on these chain of narrators that's, who are these people?
That's right.
Are they authentic or not? And he proves that these are authentic.
That's right.
And then after approving this point that the chain of narrator is authentic and is accepted by all, so then he goes to the Dilala and to the argumentation
that's
based
right.
on the text of riwayat.
Text of the riwayat.
So he tries to say, okay, this riwayat is a proof for the school of thought of Shia of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam.
That's right.
So in this way, alhamdulillah, both sides are covered.
That's
I mean,
right.
the sanad, I mean, the tracing back the riwayat to Ahlul Bayt, to the Holy Prophet.
Yes.
And then secondly, the dilalat or the reasoning that is derived from the text.
Because the Shiism was accused that some of these narrations are not authentic
and does not have
enough wusukh. So Amir Hamad Hossein Hendi shows that they are authentic, even maybe based on the Sunni references
too.
And this is the great, we can say, point.
And another important point regarding this book is that many of the subjects of the book is taken from the Sunni sources. So it's not a Shia-based book to answer the problems from own point of view, but he tries to give evidences from Sunni books. And that's the most important point regarding this book that have made it, famous.
Okay. And it was acknowledged by so many outstanding, high-quality asatid professors and scholars of the Shia world, Sheikh Mahdavi, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. And among them, we may name Allama Amini, who is the author of Al-Ghadir, he himself has authored a book in favor or in defense of Shi'ism, giving this focus on the hadith of Al-Ghadir and the incident and event of Al-Ghadir Khum. But he himself, when it comes to the point to acknowledge the book of Abaqat, he is saying very noble words and exalting this work of Marhum Mir Hamed Hussein, saying that the nice smell of this book has spread all words from the west to the east. So someone like Allama Amini, who has authored a book regarding the Imamat, is acknowledging the book of Abaqat. Again, we see Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani. He himself is considered as one of the great and outstanding codicologists who have compiled the name of more than 50,000 books in his compilation, which is called Al-Dhari'a ila Tasanif al-Shi'a. In his book, again, he is acknowledging Abaqat al-Anwar. So having this understanding about the all works from the Shia authors, he comes to this point to again acknowledge and admire the work that the author of Abaqat has conducted. So it's really a good work, and this is not except for his purity, his hard working, as it is said in the memories and stories that happened for him. They're saying that even the time his son passed away, not more than 1 hour he dedicated for the funeral thing, and the rest of the works and efforts he left it in the hands of the relatives.
His eyesight and his right hand for writing.
So it says he was a really prolific, non-stop writing author who dedicated his whole life to defend from the school of Ahlul Bayt. May Allah bless him.
May Allah bless him. That's why he was really admired by so many outstanding other scholars like Mirza Shirazi, as you said. We can say Sheikh Zainuddin Mazandarani and also Sheikh Abbas al-Qumi, who write in admiration of Abaqat al-Anwar in defense of the Shia beliefs. Safar 18, 1306, according to the Hijra calendar, is the day in which he passed away, and his body was taken to a Husainia known as Janab Qufran Ma'ab. He passed away with them, buried over there, and a commemoration session and gathering was held for him in Iraq. In Atabat. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Amin Sayyid Mahdi Abu Zafar, mainly known as Mir Hamed Hussein Hindi, known by his book Abaqat al-Anwar fi Imamat al-Aimat al-Athar. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Zainia and Sheikh Mahdavi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, and thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ENCallOfIslam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. Till another episode, God bless you. Fi amanullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.